This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Rebecca Roberts in Washington. Neil Conan is away. This coming Monday, CNN and YouTube host the next Democratic presidential debate. It's moderated by Anderson Cooper, but there's a twist. The forum will feature video questions submitted through YouTube that will then be broadcast and answered by the candidates on television. This is hardly YouTube's first venture into this political sphere. Do you remember George Allen's Macaca video or John McCain singing Bomb Bomb Iran? But this is a more organized step, and it brings to the forefront questions about the ever-increasing role of the internet in politics. What skills do presidential candidates need to possess in order to survive in this so-called YouTube election? And does presidential campaign content on websites like YouTube and MySpace really impact voter opinion? Or is it just this year's next big thing? We want to hear from you. How do you use the internet to get involved in politics? What role do you think the internet should play in the 2008 presidential election, and will it help or hurt democracy? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can also comment on our blog. It's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later, Ken Rudin on the Senate sleepover last night, John McCain's campaign troubles, and the rest of the week's political news. You can email your questions for the Political Junkie now to talk@npr.org. But first, Election 2.0. We begin with David Borman. He's Senior Vice President and the Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for CNN. He joins us via phone from New York City. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So I understand that you and Anderson Cooper have been combing through these YouTube submissions over the last couple of days. Is that a job that we should envy you or pity you for?
Oh, no, it's great. I mean, anybody can look at the clips. There are roughly about 1,500 of them that are posted up on the YouTube site right now. And it's actually great viewing. I would urge all the candidates to sit down and look at all the clips because you get a real sense of what's on people's minds.
How are you deciding what stays?
Well, there's been a group of us that's the political researchers and Anderson and his team, and a few of us have been combing through them, and we've been taking a lot of factors into consideration. There's a sheer volume of questions, inventiveness of questions, questions that by and large. You would never hear, I think, in a standard debate, questions from mainstream media journalists. So interesting, inventive, important, some with some inventiveness, perhaps a sense of humor. I think it'll have a very distinct flavor and feel, and we're combing through the clips looking for what we think will make the most interesting, compelling discussion. Because after all, this is a sanctioned debate by the Democratic Party with eight very serious candidates for president, and the candidates are all coming. There'll be a couple thousand people in the hall at the Citadel in Charleston, and it's a real debate. In your lead-in, you mentioned sort of what's the role for new media in Election 2.0. Well, this is really, in some sense, a seat at the table for new media, at the real table where decisions get made involving who gets elected to be president. And I think it'll be a fascinating evening.
For our listeners who haven't watched many of the videos, I should say, I combed through a lot of them myself today, and a lot of them are just people speaking into camera, and their questions are all over the map. But in terms of sort of production values, they're generally, someone at a desk.
Right. Actually, that surprised me the most. When I had this idea and when we began, I was in the mindset that I was going to get a lot of what I thought of as YouTube videos, which are highly produced production values. And in fact, there are a lot of those, but it's probably about 10 or 15%, I think, of the clips. The rest of them are, as you said, people who just pointed a camera at themselves or a relative. And I'm actually sort of pleasantly surprised, because what that gives us is a really broad cross section of people. I mean, everyone is like one degree of separation away from a video camera. They know someone who may have one, or they have a relative who has one. So the questions to camera, even though they're not terribly well produced or terribly well lit, represent young voters, but old voters and middle-aged voters, and all different ethnic groups, and geographically pretty widely spread. So I think because it is so simple to do, it's resulted in a really interestingly diverse group of questions.
I have to say that's what surprised me the most, is even just looking at the page where, you know, there's a freeze frame of each of the videos to choose from, and it's more or less people looking straight into the camera, the range of ages and races and both genders represented.
Yes, yes.
In terms of some of the sort of more highly produced submissions, I wanted to play a clip of one we heard today.
This here's a two-part question. Pay taxes on my clothes and food. Pay taxes on my place. Pay taxes on my moisturizer. I mean taxes on my weights. Pay taxes on my land. Every year y'all make me pay. I paid a tax on this guitar so I could sing for you today. My taxes put some kids through college I can't afford to send myself. Now tell me, if you were elected president, what would you do to help? Also, I got a parking ticket last week. Could one of y'all pardon me?
So given the range of both content and production values you've received, how much attention are you paying to whether it makes good television?
Well, I think the event, the evening, will make really good television. I think the video quality of the YouTube question doesn't matter. I think sometimes it'll, if there's a really inventive question, the one you just played is actually visually pretty interesting as well. If there's a visually interesting question, it's certainly going to help. But if it's just someone to camera or in a half shadow, it's not. I don't think it's really going to hurt, because we're going to hear the question and it's going to trigger the conversation. The hall is going to be, it's called the Field House at the Citadel. There'll be over 2,000 people in it. Our election set is pretty interesting, and we're adding to it a video screen that's about 25 feet across and about 18 feet high, and there'll be a big high-definition graphic frame in there, and in the middle of that will be the YouTube clip. So it'll be a visually interesting and rewarding experience, and I don't think the production value of the questions is going to take away at all. Occasionally it will add, because the candidate and the audience will see some of the, you know, will see the specifics of it, and there's some interesting context. You know, there are, I don't mean to sort of radically change the subject, but there are a lot of questions, for instance, on Darfur. Mm-hmm. Much more, I mean, Darfur has barely come up at the presidential debates. Clearly, there's a thread, if you go through these questions, on Darfur, and there are half a dozen questions of people who are actually in Darfur. So sometimes the production, the context or the location is actually an important ingredient, but the lack of it doesn't seem to be taking away from the meaning and the discussion that ought to follow.
I want to bring in Josh Levy. He's the associate editor of techpresident.com. He joins us from your bureau in New York. Welcome, Josh Levy.
Hello. Nice to be here.
So what do you make of this YouTube debate? Do you think it's a revolution, a gimmick? How would you characterize it?
I think it's somewhere in the middle. When we first heard about this, we were really excited that there would be this opportunity for YouTube users who, as you said, have been much more in the forefront of political discussion this year than they have in the past. And the internet itself has been in the forefront. It's great that we can bring them into this process and into the debates, which I think we can all acknowledge are not always the most exciting television or the most exciting political events. So that's really good and potentially democratic. An issue that we had at Tech President was that we felt that CNN and YouTube were only going about 50% of the way there, and that they're including YouTube users and asking them to contribute their questions. But they're not including what makes YouTube so dynamic in the first place, which is the community of users. You know, when you go to YouTube.com and you look at the most popular videos, you're looking at what the community of users has decided is really interesting. They all vote for their favorite videos, and the more that they vote for and the more that they watch, we see things rise to the top. And that's a really interesting communal experience. And that's completely missing from this debate.
So let me turn this to David Borman. Why act as a gatekeeper? Why not have this be a more direct democracy?
Well, look, I'd love to. There are actually three or four reasons. They're all really interesting. I'm going to start briefly with one that not the primary one, but the reality. Right now, I mean, we are aware of how many people are viewing these questions, and that's one of the factors we're taking into account. But I will tell you that at this moment, the question number one and number three on the list of most viewed questions, which is one of the metrics that the community might use, the number one question is actually, was Arnold Schwarzenegger elected as a cyborg to deal with a future trauma to Earth? And number three is about holding a conference on UFOs. So the community, the metrics of viewing may not result in the right set of questions for a presidential debate. As we look through questions, things that are ranked really highly are going to clearly get a really serious look from us, and we're going to try to put together the right assemblage of clips. That's only one answer. Another answer is, if we had announced that we were going to take the top 25 viewed clips, it would be, I think the dynamics would be the candidates would just brief on the top 25 clips, and we would get a rote, planned set of responses, and it would be very safe, and the questions might be a little strange, but they would have prepped for them all, and frankly, I don't think they would have agreed to that anyways. And finally, you know, remember back to the great but failed Wiki experiment in the LA Times. You know, in all the best intentions to try to get the community effort to deliver these editorials and a sense of the newspaper, it can get abused. And in fact, a fourth answer is that these can be gamed, and supporters can organize around a particular set of questions and game these things right to the top. So, you know, I'd love to be able to do it. I just think that the questions are great. There are many great questions, and I think the role of CNN here, our editorial judgment is going to be, I hope, really enlightening and good, as opposed to strangling. But we're gonna put together the best series of questions with the right follow-up, and produce the most interesting debate for President of the United States.
And we're going to let you get back to it. David Borman is Senior Vice President and the Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for CNN. He joined us today from New York City. Thanks so much.
Sure.
Josh Levy from TechPresident.com is going to stick with us. We're talking about the effect of the web on next year's election. I'm Rebecca Roberts. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. But right now we're talking about what some are calling the YouTube election. CNN's broadcast of the Democratic presidential debate on Monday night will include questions that people submitted online at YouTube.com. Is it a big break for mass democracy or just a lot of hype? Our guest is Josh Levy. He's associate editor of TechPresident.com. And let us know, how do you use the internet to get involved in politics? What role do you think the internet should play in the 2008 presidential election? And will it add an element of direct democracy? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. You can also read what other listeners have to say at our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Josh Levy, we had to say goodbye to David Borman, but I wanted to get your response to his response, that if you did take, particularly the 2 points, that if you did take the sort of top vote-getters, you would have some slightly, off-the-wall questions, but also that it would take some spontaneity away from it because the candidates could prepare.
Okay, well, and we considered these in our responses to David Borman on the website. And, listen, there's creative ways to get around these problems. First of all, you don't have to limit your criteria to the number of views of the videos, right? You can come up with something that is some kind of voting system, as this one website called communitycounts.us has done. It is linking to all of the submitted videos and inviting the YouTube community to vote for its favorite videos and also against the videos that it thinks shouldn't show up on the debates. So what you have, if you go to their front page, as I have been doing every day since they announced this debate, you see basically a very even-keeled group of submitted questions that are not crazy, that are not these crazy Arnold Schwarzenegger questions, but are very, very thoughtful, very entertaining, and would really spice up these debates and inject a whole lot of democracy into them. Second of all, there's no need to worry about making candidates see or not see these submissions. You could quite simply not show the results of the voting so that candidates and the rest of us don't see which videos are the most popular or the least popular. We will find that out on the day of the debates. So I think that there are ways to be creative about this. It's not simply that it can't be done. It can be done, but I think that CNN and YouTube want to make great television. David Borman said that himself, and part of that is having more editorial control over the content than I think the YouTube community would prefer.
Let's take a call. This is Richard in Stonington, Connecticut. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Yeah, hi. Am I on?
You are.
Yeah, hi. This is Richard calling from Stonington, Connecticut. I think it's a great conversation. Hi, Rebecca. Nice to be on with you all.
Welcome.
I just want to say I'm 46 years old. I'm a small business owner. I'm saying that just so that you know I'm not some young kid who's into the internet perhaps more than somebody my own age. I use YouTube, Google Video, a number of the other internet video sites and blogs all the time for fact-checking, to get latest breaking news, to get updates on stuff. Concrete example is this week when Chertoff had his gut feeling and the story first broke. In fact, NPR announced it very briefly between news broadcasts on my local station. I had to run home to my computer to actually find out what was really going on with that he had, you know, leaked it to the Tribune on Tuesday. And I was really pleased to find a link to an article by, for instance, Paul Craig Roberts, the former Assistant Secretary of State under the Reagan administration. Of the Treasury under the Reagan administration. I guess he was associated with the Reaganomics, the development of Reaganomics. And he wrote a fantastic article on one of the blogs that I go to about Bush's executive orders and national emergencies and his belief that there's a high likelihood of false flag terrorist attacks this summer to raise support for the war in Iraq and possibly expand it into Iran.
So, Richard, you get details online, basically, something that's sort of the backstory of what you're seeing on mainstream media.
Exactly. And also I get information about, sorry about the background noise, information about, you know, things are covered that the mainstream press just does not cover or hasn't gotten around to covering yet.
Okay, Richard, thanks for your call. Let's get a response from Josh Levy. I mean, that's certainly, you know, one of the big uses of the internet is to get more than makes the nightly news. Is that particular to an election in some way, do you think?
Absolutely. You know, what we're seeing this cycle is more than ever before, everyday citizens and voters are getting involved in the electoral process because they can, because they have things like blogs and YouTube and Facebook and MySpace that enable them to interact with each other around issues that they think are important, around candidates that they like. And now the candidates are seeing, you know, hey, there's millions of people on Facebook or on MySpace. Barack Obama can say, oh, you know, there's 2 million people that have viewed my videos on YouTube. I should probably try to interact with them, too. So there's all of a sudden this at least this medium that's enabling a conversation between candidates and voters. And more importantly, from my perspective, among voters themselves.
Well, voters are they voters?
We don't know if they're going to be voters yet. This is the first time that YouTube has been involved in an election or MySpace or Facebook. So we don't know what the result is going to be at this point.
I'm also curious what you think about the sort of flip side of this is that when candidates are more and more aware that any offhand remark at a campaign stop could show up on YouTube and be downloaded hundreds of thousands of times, are they more canned? Are they less candid?
It depends on the candidate. I think Hillary Clinton is an example of somebody who offers very canned pronouncements online as well as offline, and you don't see a significant difference in her behavior. You have other candidates that maybe have less to lose, like Dennis Kucinich, that really take advantage of this of the new medium and are much less formal in their online personas. You know, one thing that's important to think about is that the candidates are afraid, but they're also not taking advantage of something that could be really, really important to them. Joe Trippi, who is now a senior advisor to the John Edwards campaign, uses this phrase called "flood the zone," which is that, you know, sure, there's this danger of the macaca moment, you know, and what happened to George Allen, but there's also the possibility that you can kind of get to the head of that before anybody else can pull something negative out of it. And so you can have positive videos. Hillary Clinton could be showing a video every day from Iowa showing how she's interacting with everybody and behind the scenes, truly behind the scenes coverage that would take advantage of this medium and kind of thwart any negative attempt that would be made on her.
I want to bring Henry Jenkins into this conversation. He's the director of comparative media studies at MIT. He joins us from MIT studios in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome.
Happy to be here.
Henry Jenkins, what do you think about the sort of YouTube election? Do you think this is sort of this year's big hype, or do you think it's actually revolutionizing democracy in some way?
Well, I think one of the things we discover is that campaigns are one of the early adopters and adapters of new media technology. Particularly insurgent campaigns are eager to take advantage of any new platform which gives them low-cost access to voters. What we see is that things that were sort of risky in the last election cycle, like the use of blogs, like raising money on campaign online, are becoming absolutely normative, and that we're now seeing YouTube as the breakthrough technology in this election. I think the problem is that most of the campaigns still understand YouTube in a top-down manner. They see it as another channel to send campaign brochures at, whereas what's radical about YouTube is the diversity, the opportunities of participation bottom-up, the chance for new voices to be heard, and for a new language of politics to emerge. And it's a new language that I think potentially appeals to younger voters, voters who've been disenfranchised. It's a little hipper, a little more irreverent, you know, tends toward the parodic, but also underneath that parody is or can be some serious questions.
Let's hear from Philippe in Miami. Philippe, welcome to Talk of the Nation. Philippe, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I think this on this subject of this new language, I'm very concerned that with videos you can edit into whichever message that you'd like, and you'd make somebody look more liberal than they are, more conservative than they are, and I cringe a little when I think about what campaigns could do with if they send somebody out to film somebody and their other candidate in all the situations, and then they could edit whichever story that they want. So my concern is people getting the wrong sense of candidates because, admit it, I mean, if we film somebody and then cut into whichever story that we want, we may just be sending the wrong message about that candidate. I'd love to hear your view on that.
Thanks for your call. Josh Levy?
Well, I think Henry might agree with what I'm going to say is that with these new tools of being able to produce these mashups, you know, an example that this question reminds me of is the 1984 Apple video that an Obama supporter kind of mashed up and hacked and made his own that was into this anti-Hillary Clinton video. These tools are available to a lot of people now. And another thing that's available to them, though, is a certain kind of literacy where they understand that they're not supposed to just believe what they're seeing. I think a lot of people already understand that when they're watching television, that they're not necessarily watching something that's true, but something that is presented with a point of view. And that's even more so online. When people become creators of content themselves and when they create things in support of their candidates or in support of a position, they probably, I think, are more likely to understand when they see somebody else's product and video or blog post that's also coming with a point of view and that they better be armed with a certain level of critique when they're viewing it.
Henry Jenkins, would you agree with that? Do you think people
yeah,
are bringing
I actually,
skepticism to some of this content?
I actually think that the web is developing pretty strong mechanisms for people to compare notes, to read one statement against another, to add back the context that's often missing from videos that circulate on the web. And I think people are becoming more skeptical in a healthy sense, not cynical in a negative sense, of what they see online. The abuse I'm more worried about is the potential of grassroots media makers going lower than the parties themselves are likely to go. Parties have a stake in the next election. As partisan and as bad as it's been, they're places they won't go. Already in election, we're seeing videos circulating that are homophobic and build on Ann Coulter's comments about Edwards, that are racist and attack Obama, that are
but
sexist and go after Hillary.
How is that all that different from the, you know, the issue ads from third-party groups that we see on television?
I think it's part and parcel of the same thing. I think this came around, Swift voting, the use of outside groups to attack campaigns, is going to go as much through YouTube at no cost as it is through paid advertising, and it will still get the same level of news coverage. So as much as I celebrate participatory culture, we also have to recognize the potential abuses of it. And one of them is the kind of how low can you go game that citizen-produced media can engage with, and that makes democracy less attractive to participation, just as the ability of people to share ideas potentially engages people who wouldn't vote otherwise.
Josh Levy?
I agree completely. And one thing, you know, and this goes back to this idea of the most popular YouTube videos kind of floating up to the top from the bottom, or from the sides at least, is that these videos tend to not be homophobic and tend to not be racist. And I think, just as we see with Wikipedia, that you know, when you arm a community, when a community gets large and you arm it with tools to edit itself and to kind of constantly examine the content that it's producing, it tends to cancel out the negative stuff. And what you see rise to the top might not be brilliant, and it might often be pretty mediocre, but it also is fairly representative of the broad middle section of the community, and not the radical fringes.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation. Hang on, I need to just say this. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Henry Jenkins, I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No worry. But also, I totally share that belief, and I have a deep faith in the power of collective intelligence, knowledge communities. But I also, if we look at YouTube, we notice what rises to the top most often is the work that's already part of mainstream opinion. That is, if we look at the top 100 videos on YouTube on any given moment, the overwhelming majority of them are produced by white, middle-class North American males, despite the potential of people of all backgrounds to participate. And that's a product of two things. That is what I call the participation gap, the degree to which certain segments of the society don't have the exposure, the access, the social skills and cultural competencies needed to fully feel empowered in this space. And it's secondly, the filtering mechanism itself tends not to privilege diversity, but tends to look for things that people already agree with. And so the flip side of the anxiety about how low will you go is, can we in fact ensure that these participatory channels achieve the diversity that would be our ideals for a more democratic culture?
I think we have time for one more call. This is Jeff in Dixon, Illinois. Jeff, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, my question concerns how well the internet community actually represents the voting public. It seemed, you know, back in 2004, Howard Dean was, you know, the big money winner, and there's a lot of buzz about him on the internet, but when they actually came down to the primaries, he seemed to fade away. Same thing with libertarianism. It seems to be represented a lot on the internet, but not quite as well in the voting booth. I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks, Jeff. Josh Levy, let's start with you.
Well, I think that's a legitimate concern. And, you know, we saw Howard Dean crash and burn when he had to come down to the offline world in Iowa in 2004. There's been a few changes since then. And also, you know, the point about libertarianism online is well taken as well. Ron Paul, the Republican candidate, barely even registers in offline polls, but online he dominates. He dominates on YouTube, on MySpace, on Facebook. So, but you know, one thing that strikes me is that in 2005, this Pew report just came out that I think something like 14% of African American adults had broadband access in early 2005, and by early 2007, that number was up to about 40%. So what you're seeing is a lot more people are online, they have broadband connections, and they are engaging with this stuff in new ways, and they are discovering things that kind of an elite group of people already were toying with back in 2002, 2003, 2004, and it's become much more mainstream, and people are realizing that they can now contribute to this conversation online and not just passively watch it, which was happening a lot more in 2004.
Let me ask you this, Josh. Do you think the ultimate goal here is some form of direct democracy or just more participation in a representative democracy?
I think, you know, owing to the libertarian roots of the internet and the way that, the culture is very libertarian, it is a more of a direct democracy kind of perspective where, you know, people can directly, you know, a lot of people have been creating these experiments with governments and wikis where citizens can, you know, upload their ideas for what legislation should look like, and then they can interact directly with their legislators. You know, those haven't been super successful, but that's going to continue to happen. And I think a lot of people's goal is a more direct democracy because this is such a direct form of communication, unlike what we have ever seen before.
Josh Levy is associate editor of techpresident.com. He joined us today from our bureau in New York. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Henry Jenkins is the director of the Comparative Media Studies Program at MIT. He joined us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thanks to you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Senate sleeps on it but comes up short on a troop withdrawal for Iraq. John McCain finds himself short on cash and staff. The latest polls are out and nobody comes out on top. If you have questions about the week in politics, send us email. I'm Rebecca Roberts. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.